Hello and welcome to the Art Monthly talk show. I'm Chris McCormack, and today I'm joined by Tom Denman, who's a writer based in London. Tom's written about the work of Leah Clements, who, using a variety of media, the London-based artist and advocate who identifies as disabled, critiques the wellness industry and lack of access for herself and her crip kin in works that celebrate solidarity and transcendence. I wondered, Tom, your work, or your text rather, opens with quite a striking scenario, which the artist recounted in 2022. I wondered if that might be a good way to start discussion of her work. We could also start somewhere else, but I thought that one might be an interesting way to start the discussion about Leah Clements' work.
Yes, so I began with this really as an this anecdote in which she was giving a lecture at the University of Cambridge in writing for performance, and she was mourning the loss of a close friend at the time, and a raven just flew out of the fireplace through down the chimney, and she records this in an essay she published subsequently. She doesn't go into any great detail as to explaining, but the subtext is that we sometimes things happen, and we may be inclined to draw connections or not. And this kind of irrational, quote unquote, connecting is some is a tendency that we might all have, that kind of frames a lot of the thinking that goes into Clements's work, and in particular her the film that she will be showing at Pier soon.
Which is called Epiphania, is that right?
I
Which
think it's ap yeah
is that right?
I think it's Apophenia, but
Epiphania, yes, it probably sounds, it does sound more correct. Epiphania. And so this is a description of the associative trail that connects seemingly disparate items and objects together in one's mind. Is that roughly what that means? And this is what, in a way, this scenario sort of brings attention to, which is, and I think you describe it quite beautifully, it's a description of the raven itself referencing or being called a corvid, the genus of corvid, and the association with that corvid with COVID. Is that what you're making
That
of
would
that?
be an example
Yes.
of apophenia. And she doesn't mention that in the essay, but it's while I was writing, describing it, in my own writing, it suddenly occurred to me, actually, hang on a second, I'm doing apophenia as I'm making these connections myself. I'm just thinking about it.
And so the new film that she's made, tell us a bit about that. What is she showing for Pia?
So it's a film which is set in three sites of historic and contemporary sites of wellness. So one is a ancient Roman bath in Bath, which would have been a kind of it has a sort of temple-like architecture, and it follows a woman who's walking around the kind of this sort of very aqueous environment with these pools, and then it cuts to another site, which is a medieval spring, which is also a site of pilgrimage in Wales. And then it cuts to a hotel, a wellness spa in London. And these are all sites of wellness which are tied up with the systems of power. And she doesn't do a direct or an explicit critique of wellness as such, but the voiceover, which is provided by a writer called Jen Ashworth, Jen in this voiceover describes, again, in a very fragmented way, so not in a very explicit way, but she's alluding to a traumatic experience that she has had, which led to her having what she describes as apophenic thinking, which she also describes an epistemological crisis, not really being able to discern between making a genuine connection between something and with that other people would recognize, or something that is taking place solely in her own mind. and the fear and disorientation and isolation that this causes in her. And contemplating this film, I became it occurred to me that in some many ways there is a critique of wellness taking place, because as I found myself empathizing with Jen Ashworth providing the voiceover, I started it's it, it, this contrast began to develop between that and the sites of wellness, and the idea of wellness, the very word wellness, that one should kind of fixate on wellness as being the thing that we should all strive for, when maybe actually if we turned our attention a little bit more to sickness and the things which are perhaps not universal but are experienced by all of us in various ways, that might be a more constructive ingredient to solidarity.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. It's a fascinating area to sort of critique in a way. And as you said, Clements's work is not really overtly critiquing. I can think of other artists perhaps that have more overtly critiqued maybe the wellness industry in that in a more direct way. But by going through it in a more layered, associative way, are we being led to critique it in a different way? Is that really what Clements is about, these more associative trails into politics, or
Yeah, I think it's not. Yes, it's not. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's more associative. One can. I think they're very open-ended, the works. They're very ambiguous, and this is only one reading that that came to my mind when looking at it. But
yeah.
it's not. It's not. It's in no way is it didactic or telling me to look at it that way.
And I think I remember my memories of Leah Clements as well. I think the Empath Questionnaire was the first time I came across her work a while back. And then similarly, the Sickbed VR work that she showed at Space Studios in London, similarly, I think provoked a different kind of reaction. One being, I guess I really liked this work in that it was a VR headset that you donned, and then you were experiencing or subjectively placed within the kind of confines of her bed, a sick bed. And I remember liking it primarily for the reasons that VR is always seen as a sort of escape route or as a sort of tool to a technological construct for somewhere else than where you might be. And this was a sort of reaffirmation of one's stationary position, which I thought was a really quite novel and interesting critique of technology itself and what the devices often are produced to do. Is this film, in a way, then it seems less about that kind of inherent critique. It's more a sort of it's a film. I mean, it's a straightforward film in a way. Am I right in addressing it or talking about it in that way? It's a sort of a series of sequences or a narrative. Is there a narrative arc in it, or is there other kind
There is a
of
slight narrative arc, yes. As the film progresses, we start are encouraged in some ways to start thinking apophenically in some ways. I'm watching it. I'm thinking. There's one moment when I watched it, I had to go see it several times over to be convinced that it wasn't a frog, which was actually a rock in the water. I don't even know if that was entirely intentional, but I found myself doing that, making these connections, and. As is the figure in the film, as is the unnamed character who's walking through these sites, because what happens is there's a we see various spiritual or religious icons throughout. So we see this kind of Gorgon's head at the Roman bath. We see some kind of gargoyle in a architectural capital in the well, and then there's this. There's this mask that she puts on in the wellness center, and all these things, these shapes sort of come together and form a kind of hallucinatory vision at the end when she descends into the basement. And we're not told what that means necessarily. We're not even told necessarily whether this is actually what is the opposite of apophenia is the epiphany. Where we do have these illuminations, where these connections do make sense, and we're not that's left open.
Interesting. And in a sense, then, is it about the anxiety of interpretation of how we leave mean or find meaning in things? Is that part of the subject that's been?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I think one thing which occurred to me when watching it was and also I've read Jen Ashworth's book Notes Made While Falling, in which she describes in detail how her mind going into this apophenic thinking when after she goes through this traumatic medical experience. One of the things I was thinking was, yes, perhaps when we are invulnerable or when we are feeling powerless, we need to try and make connections between things. It is a way in which we kind of feel like we have a bit more of a grasp on our situation, some kind of control over something.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one hopes to find meaning in things rather than lose meaning. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that's the position of terror, isn't it? Where the things suddenly drop away. But I guess that leads us to an earlier work of hers that you do discuss, The Siren of the Deep. Which, in a way, talking about falling, it seems that's an association that's also perhaps within this work. Do you mind just giving a brief description of it?
Yep. So in this was in 2021 in a show she had at East Side Projects in Birmingham, in which she is an installation in which she had this one of those kind of makeshift swimming pools which are on stilts with a there would normally be this very taut kind of rubber or plastic lining, and then that would be filled with water. And she had one of these in the room, except I'm not quite sure what fabric she used. It didn't seem, from the images I've seen, it doesn't look like the kind of fabric one would normally associate with a swimming pool because it was all kind of folded and crinkly. Which again, I think is sort of leading into that very associative sort of thinking because it's not a clean surface. It plays on one's perception. And that was full of water. And then there was a light trained on the pool from above, which is a fluorescent light, so sort of blue. And then in the corners of the room were little glasses of water on shelves, which had a light trained on them, which was a tungsten bulb, so it was sort of orange. And they would turn on and off. And then over the and sometimes the room was more or less in pitch darkness. And overhead, you heard these descriptions by deep sea divers of their experience of when they get to a certain depth in the water. They have this sort of feeling, it sounds almost like a feeling of euphoria, to the point that they decide they actually have this urge to stay down there forever. They say it's so peaceful, so beautiful, so perfect and magical. I mean, they don't stay down there forever, but they have this urge to do so. I think one of the divers says, "If I didn't have a family and kids, I might have actually decided this is perfect. I just want to stay here forever." There's this, which is obviously a kind of not it's obviously an irrational way of thinking, because it's impossible to stay down in the water forever. But so she it just creates this environment, really. I mean, in which one is sort of draws. There's also this kind of siren song, hence the title Siren of the Deep. And I think the idea, and one feels it watching this video she made of it, at least, this draw to the water. And I think one fear, I felt this kind of, one begins to empathize with this irrational perspective. And I think a lot of Clements's work is trying to kind of blur that boundary between what is considered sane and what is insane, that this is not to try and debunk this tendency you might have to other those or separate those who are considered irrational or ill, and that seems to be one of the kind of main kind of emotional effects of the work.
I mean, it is fascinating to think about that very scenario, really, which is finding a kind of equilibrium with the world in such perilous circumstances, in a way, where you're in the bottom of the ocean or wherever you are, adrift, isolated, and this being the moment of feeling it of self acceptance or acceptance. And what that says really about our own capacity as humans, or what that says to be about our own inner lives, and how that speaks to something totally, other in a true sense, which is confounding, difficult to process, and ultimately disturbing on one level. Layer climates as well. I mean, I think we give a good sense of it. Is there anything else you feel that we should talk about within the practice that you feel, or we can sort of close it down? I urge obviously listeners to see the show, which actually opens on the 7th of February, so in London. That's then, isn't it? Yeah, that's right. And it's on till the 2nd of May.
I think her approach to accessibility in institutions, I think, is also really
Oh yeah,
important.
of course you mentioned that as well.
The
This is a document.
act she in ni in 2019 she co-authored with Lizzie Rose and Alice Hattrick this online document called Access Docs for Artists, a website, which guides disabled art workers in how to communicate to their employers their needs. And what strikes me about it is when I'm reading through these there are a few examples on the website. There's an encouragement to basically to it's very different from a it's very different from a lot of forms, bureaucratic forms that one might fill out, because it encourages the art worker to not necessarily reveal everything that they want, that they can reveal only as much as they feel comfortable revealing as to their own condition. It's a very it's a very user-friendly means of kind of communicating, and that seems to thread into the way that she records a lot of her work, making it accessible online for those hard of hearing, especially, and those visually impaired too.
And does Leia Clements have any feedback on how successful that kind of questionnaire, or that kind of rider, as they call it, has been? Has it been taken up by many people in the community?
I believe it has. I did watch a I watched an interview that she conducted a few years back through the Serpentine. I forget the name of the person she interviewed in the interview, but she was given a lot of praise for it, and it
Okay.
was described to her how important it has
Good.
been.
Good. That's great to hear that that's actually had real world consequences for many people and for many artists. Great. Okay. Well, thanks, Tom. That's a great overview of her practice. And as I said, the show opens up here on the 7th of February. So please do go see it. And it closes on the 2nd of May. So it's on for a few months. So I do advise all listeners to go see it if they can. It leaves me to say thank you again, Tom, for joining us this morning and taking the time to discuss Leia Clements' work. Many thanks.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Pleasure. Okay, now I'm joined by Bob Dickinson, who is a freelance writer based in Manchester and Argentina. His article, Art and Contested Memory, which is in the February issue coming out shortly, warns of the urgent need to preserve and protect collective memory against attempts by far-right regimes to erase it and impose instead distorted official histories. Where should we begin? I was going to ask, was the article driven by the time, by the because you're living now in Argentina? I wondered if this article was sort of spurred by what you were witnessing yourself living in this country, given that the article really sort of draws on and sort of talks about performance art as a kind of a rebuttal or a refusal of the kind of political regimes to trying to raise histories and narratives and so on. I wondered if that was driven by things that you'd actually seen and witnessed yourself.
Well, it's largely to do with the way that the current government of President Javier Milei is making efforts to close down art, the art and culture. I mean, it's and I the particular thing that spurred on this article was the closure of the Harold the Haroldo Conti Muse art gallery, which is part of a complex in Buenos Aires that used to be that was called the ESMA Center, the ESMA military complex, which was used as a torture and detention center during the military dictatorship that was in control here in Argentina between 1976 and 1983. And many people, as I've said in the article, were detained and died in this torture center, which is now a museum, and it's got this art center, and the government has closed the art center, and the government is trying to introduce this this policy of what they call complete memory, which is not just remembering the 20,000, 30,000 people, sorry, 30,000 people who disappeared under the military dictatorship. The government, current government, wants to, which is a right, ultra right-wing government, wants to remind people of the victims of left-wing terrorist violence before the military dictatorship took power. When there was a group, there were groups like the Montoneros, which were a left-wing terrorist group who targeted military, military, army units, and so on. And these killings were, they definitely happened, but there were far fewer of them than the number of people who disappeared during the dictatorship, which Milei and his party also contests. He says that the numbers that are agreed by most humanitarian organizations are an overestimation of the number of people who disappeared. So that's what. So there's this culture war that's begun around this idea of the way that quite recent history is remembered and memorized and memorialized.
And presumably, I would imagine that those left-wing militia, or however they call themselves, those left-wing groups, would see themselves as a resistance group against the far right. Or, the fascists that were taking over and killing thousands more, they viewed themselves in that way.
I mean, in the 70s there were numbers, and this was the same in other Latin American countries. There were a number of there were num a large number of left-wing paramilitary groups or terrorist groups, if you want to call them that. And there were we had them in Europe as well.
Yeah, of course. And
So
sorry, I was just going to ask the Haroldo Conti Cultural Center, which you discussed in Buenos Aires, which they are repurposing and trying to change the sort of the nature of what they show. Can you describe then what was it that was so contentious? I mean, in terms of what they were showing, given, I mean,
Well,
of course, the
it's
museum's
art.
history and building, but tell me more
They
about
had,
that.
well, when you go there, and I've been there a couple of times, and it's there is a museum where you can revisit where the places where people were detained and tortured, and it's pretty grim. There's also another building where there's an facilities to show art, contemporary art shows, and there's a sort of permanent collection of contemporary art, and I've written about it before in Art Monthly, and that is the building that's been closed, and the number of staff overall across the whole site has been reduced.
And do you see, I mean, you sort of use this then as a sort of parallel to sort of jump off into other kinds of cultures and countries, rather, that have experienced similar, well, similar kind of, and in a way, rising kinds of attempts by governments to, yeah, forge equivalences across the political positions that are clearly demarcated in very different ways. One could argue, you know, the rise of fascism and so on is now being equally, especially within the US, being made as an equivalent to the left, far left, and these kinds of ideas. That there's all this trying to forge equivalences between these groups. So in a way, that's what your article is driving home, I would say. Is that, am I correct in thinking that? Is that what you're...
I think so, and I think I wanted to also think about the way, memory, social memory, collective memory is a very complicated process, and particularly if we're talking about countries which have experienced traumatic events, such as military dictatorships. Or political oppression. I was interested in also talking to a woman, an artist called Jelena Jureša, who's Croatian, who works with dance and film, and is a whose work looks back at the way the wars that followed the breakup of Yugoslavia have been memorized, and the way memory is not a sort of smooth transition. It's a very it's it, it trauma creates fragments of memory, and I was very interested in talking to her about that. Also, to sort of remind readers that social memory of traumatic events also applies to Europe as well as Latin America. I was trying to sort of draw parallels between Europe and Latin America.
Yeah, which I think you c correctly assess, you know, through these different artworks and practices. And I think that artist Jureša, she points to these kinds of quite disturbing stories in a way, of various horrible, nightmarish consequences that took place in Bosnia and so on. And yes, yeah, you're right in pointing out how artists are attempt holding on to these quite dissonant, dislocated, and in a way, then how they become competing in a way. I suppose that's what the thing that about these memories become. They become competing forces in a collective picture, and then they, by virtue of that, they become then politicized. Should we try and discuss? I mean, in a way, it's interesting to try and bring these kinds of what seem perhaps culturally quite different contexts. I mean, of course, Europe, and we talk about the Holocaust. We talk, in this case, we talk about the war in Yugoslavia, and then trying to, I mean, I don't think you do directly. I mean, you're not trying to force an equivalence between these cultures and those of the in South America. I think that rather it's
No.
more the formal devices, or the interests of artists, rather, to try and
Sure.
resuscitate or work through these sort of, I suppose, or diagnose something of these kinds of cultural histories. Should we, which what would you like to talk about? Would you like to talk about these connections within Europe or within South America? Which, where do you want to?
The article actually starts with Horst Hochheisel, the German artist who chose to well he works with what he calls counter monuments. So I started with him because I wanted to look at something that's quite familiar to European people, European readers of Art Monthly maybe, the idea of the war memorial and the Brandenburg Gate, which was thought, which at when East Germany collapsed in the 1990s, or 1989, there was this the Brandenburg Gate became symbolic of a reunited Germany, and Helmut Kohl met the East German Prime Minister Hans Modrow under the gate. They shook hands, everybody cheered, and then Leonard Bernstein, a couple of days later, conducted the Berlin Philharmonic in Beethoven's Ninth Symphony right there at the Brandenburg Gate, you know, and it which is which concludes with the Ode to Joy, of course, so great happiness. But Hohenzollern saw this whole thing completely differently. He sees these kind of monuments completely differently, and his proposal in the 1990s was to blow up, to completely demolish, using explosives, the Brandenburg Gate, grind it to dust, and then bury the dust under flagstones, because the gateway to him, which is a, it was a kind of symbol of military victory. It was a monument to German victories in the 19th century, 18th century. But he felt that it also reminded the whole idea of a gateway. He couldn't get out of his mind the gateway to Auschwitz with the words "Arbeit macht frei," work makes you free, over that gate. So he was not able to grind up the Brandenburg Gate, not surprisingly, but he was able to, a few years later, do a light projection of the Auschwitz gateway, the image of that gateway, onto the Brandenburg Gate, which is a pretty shocking. Well, it's an amazing photograph when you if you see the photograph of it. So I and he's Hohenzollern has done other works in other parts of the world, including Buenos Aires here in Argentina. So he's very motivated by this idea of social memory. So that was my jumping off point. And yeah, I took I but I had in mind that I wanted to talk about what was happening here in Argentina right now, and in Chile and in other countries, because of the way governments in this part of the world are increasingly turning to extreme right-wing politics.
Yeah. And in a sense, then what's interesting is by assessing, I mean, it's kind of, I think what's interesting about your article is the way you survey these things and also bring together practices, I guess, that are not just contemporary, but also made through, the 60s, 70s, 80s. That it's a sort of a survey of a kind of practice that's, it's a thread that runs through a kind of culture that's, and a way you're trying to trace these connections across generations of artists' practices. In a way, it's the consistency by which these patterns exist, I suppose, that's sort of depressing on one level, that we're continually faced with these kinds of forms of oppression. I guess it's interesting to think about how they're being remade today, under very perhaps different circumstances with different intents and purposes, given how communication is different and so on and so forth. Do you want to talk a little bit about these kinds of positions of history in a way? Because I think that's what's interesting too, these different pivots maybe between, these more archival works that you describe. I can think of, Carlos Lepe, this work from the 1980s through to more current works, but it's sort of interesting to think about these different generations as well.
I mean, I was interested in Carlos Lepe because I found out that he'd rescued a tapestry called Crowd 3, which was originally made by an artist called Gracia Barrios, and we're talking about Chile now. And I've written about art, contemporary art in Chile before. I've written about Lottie Rosenfeld and the way she worked in during the dictatorship at night in Santiago, painting crosses over the lines in the road as a way of confusing people and also reminding people that the dictatorship wasn't in complete control of everything you saw, and that the decisions that the dictatorship was making could be contradicted. I think that's how I would have read it.
Yeah. Also,
They also, sorry.
I was going to say it's also kind of a memorial, a kind of a punk memorial
Yeah,
in a
yes.
way, you know, this sort of
For the
crosses
people who were
that become.
disappearing. Yes. But I've also, I'm very interested in the way that, you know, performance art in under that dictatorship, under that dictatorship, performance art actually survived and defied the dictatorship, and by actually performing, going out in public, staging performances, it was a way of not just defying the rules and regulations of dictatorship, but a way of saying that, you know, artists can do something that's free and liberating. And I was looking at Lepe's photographs of Lepe's performances, and I just thought, these look really, really amazing. And they were done under a military dictatorship. And I also write in the article about Alias Adasme, who did this piece called "Art Must Be Inescapable," which he has recently, well, last year he repeated, which is a kind of living mural, he calls it, where he walked through the center of Santiago with this slogan, "Art Must Be Inescapable," in Spanish, of course, on a t-shirt in 1980, and gave out leaflets. And he recently, as I said, revived this piece, and spoke about the rise of historical denialism in Chile, and talked about the way political polarization in Chile and other Latin American countries is part of the way that these ultra-right-wing political groups are achieving power. And since that happened, there has been another general election in Chile, and they have elected an ultra-right-wing president who takes power in a matter of weeks from now,
Wow.
Antonio Kast, whose father was a Nazi.
Yeah, you mentioned, yes, disturbing fact. And also speaks back to, I mean, in a way, this is the kind of it's an interesting point, isn't it, really, which is to say the outcome of even the Holocaust and the kind of the positions you're talking, you know, the sort of history you're describing there, which of course many Nazi members, you know, fled to South America infamously.
Yes, they did.
So one perhaps sees these seeds also forming or being reborn as well through that kind of history, perhaps. I mean, yeah, it's sort of fascinating to think of that, these sort of lineages and connections and how they continue to be manifested, either directly or indirectly. But I'd like to know a little bit more about Carlos Lepe's work. I've not seen any of the videos myself, so I would actually be quite interested to know a little bit more about the work and what he's doing as a performance artist in this work.
Yes, I mean, he's a completely new name to me. When I was doing my research for the article, and I was really amazed by what I found, and I would like to find out more about him as well.
Because the images are quite striking. I mean, I've got this
Yes, they
image
are.
here of the singers from 1980, but I'm just wondering what he's doing. He looks to be in some sort of plaster cast,
Yes.
in full makeup.
Yes. I haven't seen the way the what you've done with the feature in the
I
Art Monthly
know.
yet. Have you
Yes,
used photos of Lepe?
we have that image in the
Oh, good.
article. Yeah. But I've not I've not seen the works by him. But one artist you do talk about as well is Liv Shulman. And
Yes.
she is in Argentina. I'm correct in thinking that she's an Argentine.
Yeah, she's in her 30s, I think. She's quite young,
So a more contemporary response then to the situation here. Could you describe something about work to us and what her context or background is?
Well, I was really interested in her because she's not really talking about the dictatorship at all. She's talking about the new mindset, should we say, that they have tried, or that Milei's government has encouraged, which is to sort of I'll use the word atomized the society, which is it's to do with, I suppose, answering the question, why do people vote for people like Milei in the first place? I mean, Milei is not a Nazi, but he's a kind of he's a libertarian capitalist, and he calls himself an anarcho-capitalist, and he's quite famous for traveling around doing public appearances with a chainsaw because he wanted to take a chainsaw to government spending and waste.
This I've
And
seen.
he's just been and he was rescued, of course, by Trump last year. The Argentine economy was rescued with a $20 billion sum from Trump. So I've always wondered, why do people vote for people like Milei? And last October, I was in Buenos Aires, and I was going to a local subway station to meet my wife, and the place was completely surrounded with police, and I thought, there's something going on. And there was a small counter demonstration going on my side of the road, and then on the other side of the road, which is Corrientes Avenue, big long avenue. On the other side of the road, there were all these people walking in a long line, endless numbers of them, coming out of the subway station on the other side. And these were Milei supporters on their way to a local rock venue, a huge arena actually called Movistar Arena, to watch Milei do a book launch. With a rock show, because Milei is a frustrated rock star who I believe used to have a Rolling Stones tribute band. Anyway, later on that night, we saw this show on the TV, and it's absolutely he is absolutely terrible. He can't sing. He doesn't play an instrument or anything like that. It's big packed stadium full of his fans, and it was interesting watching them walking down that avenue on the way to the gig, because a lot of them were very young people and quite well dressed. And you get this idea that a lot of people who voted for Milei are they want to get on in life. They want to vote for somebody who will create opportunities for them to make a bit of money. And this is what Liv Shulman seems to be able to home in on, especially on in one of her works, which is called A Circle That Rolled Away, which is a video, which is very cleverly done. She sort of choreographed a large group of performers to move around the center of the financial center of Buenos Aires, and the camera comes in on and moves around from one couple of speakers to another couple of speakers that just come along. They all arrive and depart from different directions, and the camera picks up on all of them and picks up on their conversations. And these conversations are sort of semi-absurd, but I've quoted one of them where two young women are walking along a street, and they're talking about a third person, and one of them says she has a major sign of unadaptability, and she says unadaptability in Spanish. She doesn't seek to improve. She doesn't make plans. She doesn't look at horoscopes and make predictions, which is what everyone does now. So it's like this whole idea of thinking about the future, of planning the future, of trying to make a better future for yourself, even if it means you're looking at horoscopes.
Yeah.
And of course, the Milei government has they do have a kind of cult figure that they who's called who's called, nicknamed the Argentinian Nostradamus, who was a painter called Benjamin Pallavicini, who predicted the arrival of this mysterious grey man who would reconcile the extreme black and white of Argentinian society. And I discovered that one of the, Milei's advisors actually has got one of this guy, Pallavicini's drawings tattooed on his back, a man called Sergio Caputo, who's one of Milei's main advisors. So I was really interested in the way Milei is trying to encourage people to work for the future, even if there's no evidence that they're ever going to get anywhere, and dream about the future and stop thinking about the past as a way of kind of counteracting social memory. That was why I wrote about Liv
Interesting.
Schulte.
I mean, that is interesting. It's fixating on the future to avoid the kind of complexities of the past, or rather, even not even just the complexities, rather even the political pitfalls and or having to deal with the consequences of that. Also seems to play into that. I feel like it's interesting that we've not really discussed Donald Trump, given his invasion of Venezuela. I guess in a way he seems as a sort of equal to, if not superior, of many of these dictators as well. If there's a
Well, yeah, I mean,
theory.
the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro happened when I was sort of in the final stages of writing the article, and I thought I've just got to have to mention this because it's happening right now. But I mean, Trump is clearly, well, for people here, for certain people here, people on the left or progressive people, Trump is a colonial adversary. He's either invading you or he's taking over your economy. And but of course he is the hero of people like Milei. In fact, last week, I think it was last week, Milei was parodied on the United States comedy show Saturday Night Live by a comedian called Marcelo Hernandez, who's a Cuban comedian. They did a sketch called the Trump Awards, which I saw, and Milei, this guy comes on disguised as Milei, and he talks in adoring terms about Trump as the guy who seriously just threw $20 billion at me, and he talks about Trump as my body goal. I want to be like him physically. And then he has to open an envelope for the best foreign language film, and he picks out a card, and it's just completely blank. And he says there's nothing there. And then he says, "Oh, I've just found another $10 billion. This guy is awesome, bro." And that's quite telling about the way Milei is seen in the United States, I think, as well.
I guess this sort of, this image of the strong man, the political strong man that is happening not just in the US, South America, we can look at Russia, China, all of these cultures, this idea of democracy itself in a way, which has this, almost a bad rap to all of these countries. Do you think that artists, in a sense, are offering us a position or something that's counter to, I mean, they are, but I would say, I'm just asking you, where you think that is evident in, let's say, artists you're seeing in South America?
Well, I think the most sort of hopeful
Yeah.
or yeah, the most hopeful and wisest work that I've written about in this piece is work by Paz Encina, the Paraguayan filmmaker whose work I didn't really know at all before I started looking into her work, into her filmmaking. And Paraguay was one of these countries that was a dictatorship in the 1980s. Well, from the 1950s actually, because the Paraguayan dictator was a guy called Alfredo Stroessner, and it's similar to Argentina, Chile, and so on, and Brazil. His government disappeared thousands of people, and Encina, Paz Encina, is a filmmaker who's interested in this whole idea of disappearance. What it does to you, what it does to families who've lost someone, and her first sort of significant film was a feature film called Paraguayan Hammock, which is about it's about a couple, a fictional couple who are waiting for their son to come back from a war called the Chaco War, which happened in the 1930s between Paraguay and Bolivia, and many thousands of Paraguayan troops died in this war. And in this film, you just see a couple talking to each other and talking to their son in the soundtrack, in and around this hammock. They set the hammock up, they sit in the hammock, they move around the hammock. It's a very it's she Paz Encina uses long static shots. It's a film basically about waiting and
Yeah.
what it's like to wait for something or somebody to come back, and then you know that this guy is never going to come back. Then I saw her what she calls a situational documentary called Memory Exercises, which is a film she made with the collaboration of the family of a man called Agustin Goiburu, who was a politician and a doctor and an opponent of Alfredo Stroessner, the dictator of Paraguay. And Goiburu was disappeared in the 1980s, body never rediscovered. But Paz Encina made contact with his children and grandchildren and worked with them to do filming in one in 14 different locations where Goiburu hid from the authorities with his children during the 1960s and 70s, and planned to assassinate Stroessner, and all these plans failed. But his children, who are now adults, and his children, who are now adults, are interviewed in Encina's film, and you hear their voices talking about their childhoods while you're watching the grandchildren playing and swimming in the river and doing all that kind of thing. And it's very gentle.
I
And
guess that.
the river is a kind of cleansing symbol that goes right the way through the film. And then suddenly you're introduced to the what are called the Paraguayan Archives of Terror. You see them flashing up on the screen. Encina works in a very interesting way. She starts with the soundtrack. She's musically trained, so she thinks about timings, and she works with the soundtrack first, and then the pictures come second, which is like the other way around from the way film directors usually work. And you see these documents from the Archives of Terror, which were discovered in 1992,
Oh, wow.
which are very detailed records right, 70,000 documents documenting the disappearances of people in Paraguay. Many of them were very young, some of them were children, and completely by accident, in amongst these documents, there was proof, the only proof that was ever discovered, of Operation Condor, which was a coordinated intelligence network that was organized by the US, the CIA in the USA, to collaborate intelligence between Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, and Paraguay. And
Amazing.
that was discovered in the Paraguayan Archives of Terror,
Well,
completely by accident.
unfortunately, Bob, I'm going to have to wrap it up there.
Oh, sorry, right. Okay.
We've really exceeded our work time here, but so I'm going to have to say quickly, thank you for taking the time this morning to describe your feature, and I urge all listeners to check out Bob's article in the current issue of Art Monthly. So, thanks so much, Bob, for your time, and I
It's a
hope
pleasure.
at some point, we can actually have time to see these works in Europe and beyond.
I do.
Many thanks again.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris. See
Thanks,
you
Bob.
again soon.
See
Take
you.
care. Bye-bye.
Bye bye. Bye
Bye.
bye. And just a reminder that all the articles discussed today are available to read in the current issue of Art Monthly. And do please subscribe to the magazine, and details can be found on our website at www.artmonthly.co.uk. Many thanks for listening. Bye bye.